Welcome to Short Story Today, where we celebrate short stories and the authors who write them. I'm John DeSavino, and I'll be your host. This week, we celebrate Utah author Allison Field Bell. You can find her work, both fiction and nonfiction, in Smoke Long Quarterly, The Gettysburg Review, Shenandoah, New Orleans Review, West Branch, Epiphany, The Cincinnati Review, Alaska Quarterly Review, The Pinch, and elsewhere. She is a 2023 residency winner for the Writing by Writers Wolf House Residency and a recipient of the 2023-2024 Stephenson Cannon Graduate Fellowship. She was awarded New Mexico State University's Mercedes Delos Jacobs Book Prize in Fiction for her story collection, Be a Woman. She's currently pursuing her PhD in prose at the University of Utah. Today I'll be reading her story, River Mountain Summer. But first, let's listen to my interview with Allison, which took place on May 20th of this year. I'd like to welcome Allison Field Bell to the podcast. How are you today, Allison?
I'm great. I'm really happy to be here.
It's good to see you. We got to meet in real life at the AWP convention in Seattle, which was really great getting to see authors like you in real life. And we were just talking prior to starting this recording about, you know, that experience and how overwhelming it can be. So
yeah.
Can you just tell us a little bit about, you know, the things that you felt that you got out of it that were really of greatest benefit to you?
Yeah, well, I've been to AWP. This is my fourth year going. So I learned the ropes the first year where I bought way too many literary journals and my suitcase was too heavy. And so I learned that the first year and have not repeated that mistake. But it's always so exciting to peruse the book fair and to see what everyone's publishing. And I went to a couple great panels. One panel in particular was a panel with some younger agents who were talking about advice that they would give to writers. And that was super helpful. Got to meet some really amazing people there. So, and just reconnect with some folks from my MFA program and some friends from across the country was really wonderful, including you, John.
So. Yeah. I'm looking forward to next year because it was my first time. And now that I have some understanding of how it functions, I'll be more sensible in the way I go about things. But yeah, no, it was so great to be able to see you and some of the other authors who have been or will be on the podcast. So before we get into talking about the stories, can you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Yeah. So I grew up in a small town in Northern California called Sebastopol. It's in Sonoma County. But I haven't lived there since I was, I've sort of been there on and off. But mostly I haven't lived there since I was 18. I've lived mostly in the desert, in New Mexico and Arizona, and then now in Utah, where I'm pursuing my PhD in creative writing. I did my MFA in fiction at New Mexico State University in Las Cruces. And I also started an MFA in Indianapolis at Butler University. So I've been sort of all across the country a little bit. And yeah, I love the desert. I'm working on my PhD right now in Utah and studying prose mostly, but I am writing poetry and I write nonfiction and fiction as well. So
Utah is a desert state, right? So I think a lot of people who end up at school in Utah from other places, that's a real culture shock, getting used to the climate there. But for you, there was no adjustment necessary, it sounds like.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I moved to Utah from Phoenix. I moved to Salt Lake City from Phoenix. And when my partner and I were packing up the U-Haul in Phoenix, it was 117 degrees. So moving to Utah was like, yeah, I know people, it is technically the high desert and people feel like it's a desert, but for me, it feels like very lush and green. So
it sounds like you're enjoying your time there.
Yeah, I love the mountains. I thought I would never live away from the ocean when I was younger. But something about the desert and the mountains sort of substitute for the ocean in a way, which I know sounds bizarre to people who live by the ocean. But for me, it's something about terminal horizons and having a sort of like way out of the city that is really helpful for me. And Tucson was like that. Phoenix was like that a little bit, although I didn't love living in Phoenix, just personally. And Utah is definitely like that. Salt Lake City is definitely like that.
Yeah. I want to talk about your stories and your nonfiction as well. And one of the things that we talked about when we first met in a get to know you conversation that we had was, you know, I had reached out to you because I was putting together a panel, a conversation with Jewish writers. And then in our discussion, I learned some things about you that made me feel like maybe you should be here by yourself talking one-on-one with me. And some of that had to do with some of the challenges that you've had.
I would consider myself neuroatypical. I'm diagnosed bipolar 2, and it's been something that has been a challenge throughout my life. It's also been sort of something that has shaped me, obviously, in somewhat, if we can look at like a silver lining to it, positive ways. It's inspired my creativity in a lot of ways. Of course, ultimately, those ways become rather self-destructive. But it's been a challenge throughout my life. For as long as I can remember, I've struggled with anxiety, even when I was a little kid. And then in high school is when I really started struggling with the bipolar, I believe. So.
Mm. And you've obviously been able to manage it in your life. And were you young when they first diagnosed you with that?
I was 21 when I was sort of unofficially diagnosed. And then I believe I got a more formal, I was diagnosed by a therapist, so technically doesn't count. Mm. And then I believe I got a formal diagnosis when I was more in my mid 20s, like 24, 25. I can't remember exactly. And went on medication after that.
Mm. And this is something else that you and I talked about in our first conversation. I have in my immediate family, there are people, you know, who suffer from bipolar disorder. And I've seen just how extreme the extremes can be. And as a child and as an adult, and it's frightening, it doesn't matter, you know, even as an adult, when you have an understanding of it, it can be very frightening to see someone going through those extreme changes. And it's genetic, you're predisposed. Is that something that you've had an ability to see, you know, in your ancestry at all, and have a better understanding of because of that?
Yeah, so it's interesting because my parents are very well adjusted. They're like, they don't seem to have any diagnosable illnesses, at least mental illnesses. But in theory, my two grandmothers, my paternal and my maternal grandmother, both struggled with mental illness, although it wasn't really diagnosed. And my maternal grandmother, Ethel, she passed away when my mom was in her early 20s, so I never met her. But she dealt with alcoholism. She probably dealt with bipolar, but undiagnosed. But from the stories that my mother tells me, I sort of conjecture that she did have bipolar, which is maybe not fair for me to diagnose. I'm not a psychiatrist. But I think it's helpful for me to sort of think about, inheriting this as like part of my identity instead of such a, you know, part of it is like trying to accept it as part of my identity and not feel like it's completely the enemy, which sometimes it does feel like that, feel like you're in a battle with yourself a lot of the time, but trying to sort of incorporate that headspace into how I live my life and sort of thinking about my grandmother suffering from it has helped in some ways. And I really write about that a lot. I have an essay that just came out in Phoebe that talks about that, talks about my maternal grandmother and grandfather. And then I have the novel I'm working on talks about that a lot as well. Wow. So.
Mm. Now, the fact that they did not have a diagnosis for this, and it's not like it goes back that far when they didn't have, you know, they only have come up with a diagnosis for this relatively recently. My father was bipolar and his behavior, no one quite understood, you know, what that stemmed from until in middle age, he was finally diagnosed as being bipolar. And then he began to be treated for it. But I think in the old days, alcoholism kind of masked some of this too. I think a lot of people who suffered from this tended to drink quite a bit. And I'm not quite sure where I'm leading with this, but it, you know, it's interesting that the amount that's been learned about it just in recent years and the changes in the way it's addressed and treated. It just makes me glad for younger people who are being diagnosed with it. But the thing about your writing is that you have found a way to kind of address this head on in your writing. And it sounds like you're getting a real benefit from this. Obviously, you're consciously pursuing this as a subject in your writing. Obviously, with nonfiction, it's a whole different way of approaching an essay from this point of view. But you're doing some amazing things in your fiction as well, which I do want to talk about. But let's start off talking about the essay of the eating variety. How recently did you write that one?
So that is actually a story.
Oh, it is.
It is a fiction.
Oh, it is. Okay.
But a very thinly veiled fiction.
Okay. Okay. I don't know why. For some reason, I was thinking that it was a CNF piece, but that's even better in some way. So that is fiction. Okay.
Yeah. So that one I wrote in 2016. So it's been a minute, but okay. It was, I mean, I think it's very telling that you read it as an essay because it is, I would call it, I know this term is controversial, but I would call it autofiction. It's very close to experiences that I've had. As sort of an extension of my lovely extension of my bipolar, I also struggled with an eating disorder. And that's what that story really delves into. And I think like the fictional elements are like, I changed the narrator's, it was really the narrator's cousin who it's talking about, and I changed it to her brother. And so there's not like a ton of fiction in there. But the way the story is shaped, you know, my nonfiction, I feel very strongly that I need to be true to the experience. And if I can't remember certain bits of dialogue, I acknowledge that in the essay itself. So fiction allows me to sort of have this breathing room to explore and put things on the page that are similar to what happened, but aren't necessarily true to my memory because I can't remember them, or for whatever reason, I want to change something, tweak something a little bit.
Mm-hmm. And the eating disorder is bulimia, we should say, right? And in the story, it's kind of an interior monologue, right? Mm-hmm. Where this woman is sitting, eating an almond croissant and kind of thinking about the course of events that will probably take place within the next hour of her life as she's sitting there eating this almond croissant,
right.
which she refers to as self-care. I love it.
Right.
Eating the croissant. But things happen in the course of the story. And, you know, it's not an easy read, obviously. You know, it deals with some harsh realities. I learned so much from the story, I have to say, I know something about bulimia. But through fiction, this is what you've done. Through fiction, it allowed me to get into the mind of a person and kind of live, almost like share a lived experience that this person is having. And that, for me, is a true gift of fiction. And even though you say this is kind of like thinly veiled autofiction, it's fiction, you know, technically it's fiction, but you have a personal knowledge based on personal experience that you are able to translate in a way that will teach the reader something. So, you know, this is always a point that I'm making on this podcast. Through writing like yours, with your gifts, it's not just entertainment. You know, I'm taking something of real significance away from the experience of reading the story. So, that was a kind of a long-winded way of saying thank you for writing the story, because it's amazing. But maybe if you could tell us a little bit about what that experience was like, writing about the, you know, the whole kind of ritual of going into, you know, at home, you don't have to worry about upsetting someone in public. There's a big section of this story where the narrator is going into a public restroom and discussing all the ways that you have to kind of mask this self-inflicted part of the ritual of bulimia. So was that really difficult writing that?
So it's interesting. I'll start with a little bit of a long-winded response, but I'll start by just saying that, first of all, thank you for saying those things about the story. I think that when I started writing fiction, I thought that I really wanted to experience those moments of, we can call them empathy, or I know that that is problematic to think about fiction as an experience of empathy, but I do think that when I first started writing fiction, I wanted to experience those moments of empathy myself on the page. So I wrote a lot of characters who were difficult for me to understand. A lot of my fiction was written from the point of view of men and, you know, like not great men. And I was really curious in experiencing a moment of empathy on the page as I was writing. And what I realized when I got to New Mexico State is that what I needed to be doing was actually for myself in this moment, and this will probably change as I grow as a writer, but in this moment and in the moment since I was at New Mexico State, I have felt like really I need to be writing closer to my experience in order to create that experience of empathy for the reader. So I think that this story, in a way, I would like to say it was really hard and it was, you know, I processed all these things when I wrote it, but this story in particular, it came out really quickly. I wrote it in like one or two sittings, which is unheard of for me. And I felt like it just sort of wrote itself in a way, which I know writers talk about that experience sometimes, and it sounds a little oovy groovy, but in this case, it really did. I think it was like in my brain space for so long that it just came out really naturally. And I didn't even, I mean, there are definitely some edits that I made on it, but nothing major when I went to edit the story. So yeah, I think it was actually just one of those things that needed to be written for me. And I do have some of those ideas and stories and essays that feel like there's a kind of urgency to them. And this was one of those stories.
And the fact that it was written, that's a while ago that you wrote this. Sometimes when people are thinking back on stories that they wrote 5-6 years ago, you said this was 2017?
2016 and 2017, I started editing it.
So, that's a significant amount of time. A lot of the times, you know, people will look back at these pieces and think, you know, have some kind of misgivings about them and feel like they've changed as a writer. Not always, but often I hear writers say, oh, that's an old story, as if it was, you know, before I became the writer I am today, right? But in reading the story, it's such a solid story. I can imagine you must still be proud of the story and feel like it holds up, a good example of what you're capable of doing, right?
Well, I definitely appreciate you saying that. I do like this story, and I think it's doing a lot of work towards that destigmatization of mental health. And when I read the story, I actually read it for my MFA reading. So I read it out loud to a room full of people, and people laugh. It's like, it's funny.
Well,
so
it is.
It's devastating, right? But it's also funny. And I think that that sort of ability to sort of step back and see these situations with humor, I think is super important for me in my own processing of my mental health. And I think it can be sort of humanizing in a way, right? To create narrators who, yes, like this woman is going through this intense situation, but there's also humor, right?
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, because there is, absolutely. And this character, there's irony to all of this in her mind, you know, and she kind of takes pleasure in the irony of some of these things. And it's a very kind of dry humor that comes across. And I can imagine people laughing, you know, who would hear this being read out loud, even in the context of what she's going through. She's still able to kind of wink and laugh at herself through the experience. I want to move from this story to She Can't Get Off the Floor, where this character is also struggling with something, but having a much harder time with it. She Can't Get Off the Floor is the perfect title, because it really kind of says exactly what's happening in the story, which is about a housewife who is home alone after her kids have gone to school and her husband's gone to work, and she's come out of the shower and she finds herself lying face down on the carpet in her bedroom. And this again is an interior monologue. Not as many places for humor in this story, right?
Yeah, that's true.
This is so amazing, this story. And I that word is like so inadequate, but in what it conveys in this woman's experience of lying on the floor face down and just kind of thinking about where she is and why she's there and how does she get up. And I just was totally knocked out by this story. I had to like just kind of sit in silence for a while afterwards because it just left such a huge impact. It deals head on with depression, the lowest of lows of depression. I don't know if this character is bipolar necessarily, but she's at the lowest point of in her depression. Tell us something about the experience of writing this particular story.
Yeah, so this story is, I sort of think of it as, I have a story collection in progress, and I think of it as one of three stories that are these interior monologue stories. And they're all from different characters' points of view. And this one is from, in the book, it's from Maddie's point of view. So this is really a story that, again, it's like less auto-fictional than Of the Eating Variety, just in logistics of this woman's life. I don't have kids. I'm not married. But this story is dealing with an experience that I had when I was really deep in a depression. And I actually sort of had to put my life on hold. I think I was 32 when this happened. I had to put my life on hold, move back in with my parents, and I ended up doing an intensive outpatient program. But I was really struggling. I had gone off my medication I was on before, and things just sort of unraveled from there. And really struggling, really had this experience where I literally could not get off the floor of the room I was staying in my parents' house. So that's what inspired this story. And obviously there's a lot of fictional elements to it, but just exploring that interior space of a person who is really stuck. And, you know, I think that in the story, the woman in the story is stuck in her mind. She's stuck on the floor, like she's stuck in her mind and her body. And I think that the weight of depression, I think, is something that people do talk about, but how it really becomes this kind of anchor for you that fixes you in certain places, whether that's like psychological or actual physical places, like a carpeted floor, right? So yeah, that's where that story came from. This one was a little harder to write, I think, just because the experience was fresher to me when I wrote it. And I believe I wrote it the summer before I started my PhD program here. So 2020, summer of 2020. And I might have started writing it in when I was living in Phoenix before that. So I was already feeling this kind of like claustrophobia and trappedness that I think a lot of us felt during 2020. And I think that combined with my actual experience of being stuck on the floor at my parents' house sort of produced this story.
The whole thing that you're thinking and that she's thinking when you're reading the story is, you know, what is it that's going to get her up off the floor? And the things that she goes through in her mind, I mean, the most beautiful thing was, I mean, she manages to turn over and she's looking at the ceiling, and then she starts to think about the successes that she's had as a mom. And then, you know, this is where she's saying, it's not okay for me to be lying on the floor looking at the ceiling of my bedroom. If I were outdoors, you know, lying in the grass looking at the stars at night, that would be acceptable. This is unacceptable. And then she remembers this experience she's had with her two teenage children who reluctantly go with her one night in her husband's truck. And they lie, she knows there's going to be a meteor shower, and they lie in the back in the bed of this truck. And when these meteors start to rush across the sky, the kids all are like, wow, you know, then they're like, they're into it. That I would imagine was fictional, right? That was one of the elements that you added that was completely from your imagination. And that is just an astonishing moment in that story. And you just learn so much about this mother and her way of seeing her role in the lives of her children and the lives of her husband. Wow. Now, you sent me that as a PDF. Has that been published in something?
No, so that one has not been published. I sent it out a little bit, but then because my story collection, I have about a little more than half of the stories published, and I was advised to sort of not publish more stories if I wanted the collection to actually come out as a book.
Okay.
So I've sort of been sitting on that one and haven't been sending it out. So
okay, interesting. So as part of your PhD, is that going to be the end goal, is to create this collection to complete your PhD?
I actually have I have the book completed-ish. I mean, as completed as any book is before it's published, and even after it's published, right? So that book I started working on in my MFA, and so I've my first year in my PhD, I swapped out a bunch of stories, wrote new stories, and I actually ended up turning it into like a linked story collection where I sort of compressed characters and combined characters, and so it's really it re revolves around four different women. Each story sort of delves into their separate lives and how they like eventually sort of overlap. And it's called Bodies of Other Women. So I'm trying to get that published right now. And I also wrote my second year in my PhD program, I wrote a collection of flash essays that I'm also trying to get published. So my goal for my dissertation is to work on this novel that I have about 90 pages of so far. So I'm trying to have quite a few books, but none published yet. So
But that's great that when you're done with the program there, you will have some finished pieces ready to shop around. And I'm sure at this stage of things, you're not really probably thinking about things like agents and looking into, how these will become published works, or are you?
I've started to think about that. It's a little as folks who write know, it can be very difficult to get an agent with a story collection. And so I'm in conversation with a few different people, but no signing yet. So we'll see what happens. I'm trying to really focus my attention on the novel right now. So and really just trying to be patient. So in pursuing my PhD, I decided that I really wanted to be a professor. That was sort of the route that I wanted to take. And in order to really do that, you do need to have a book or multiple books published to sort of land a tenure track job. And so I do feel a lot of pressure to get a book out there, but I'm also trying to be patient because I want it to be the best book possible, right? I'm not trying to rush it or anything. So, and it is a long process for some people. For me, like most of this writing journey has been a very long process. So it makes sense that this is too.
Yeah, and while you're still studying, you're in a little bit of a different situation than some people. I guess, that gives you a little bit more space to think about how your life is going to look when you come out of the PhD program there. So yeah, just enjoy that while you can. Obviously, there are real advantages to that. So, you're going to be able to complete these works and get them in shape to present to agents and possibly publishing houses. So I'm very excited about the idea of the short story collection, of course, because that's my thing and that's what this podcast is about. But I'm curious about the novel too. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about that if you feel like it. Is there anything about the novel that you'd feel comfortable sharing?
Sure, yeah. So the novel is very much in progress. It's still taking shape in ways that are unexpected. But I would say like the sort of premise is that it is autofictional as well, and it's this narrator, Ari is her name, and she has just moved from California to Indiana with her partner James, who is in medical school in Indiana. So, I mean, that alone is like straight out of my life, basically. And she is struggling a lot with mental illness. So again, it's engaging with this topic that seems to be a kind of, for lack of a better word, obsession of mine. I can't not write about it, and I'm hoping I can sort of like write through it, and then I can write about other things. But for now, it's something that is just dominating my brain space. So, and that's manifesting in my fiction and nonfiction and everything that I write, basically. So I'm trying to accept that and just be okay with that for now. So yeah, this novel, Ari is struggling with her mental health, and she has this very like sharp sense of humor. So I think it's similar to of the eating variety in tone in a way where it's like some of the stuff is pretty dark, but also hard not to laugh at it. At least I laugh at it. So I hope other people would. And yeah, and so she's moved to Indiana. She's totally uprooted herself from her friends, from her family. She is not talking to her parents, but she does have a brother, Danny, who she's very close to, and they have this very like sardonic relationship. that is kind of fun to watch. And it occurs just over the phone for now. But I think Dani will probably come out to Indiana to try to kind of rescue her. I'm not exactly sure. And then she has a friend, Maya, who has moved to Louisville, Kentucky, and is getting married. And this friend, Ari, sort of has a very complicated past with and potentially a future with. I haven't fully decided, but I think some kind of affair might be in the works, but I don't want to spoil it.
Yet, so. Wow. All right. Well, there's a lot to unpack in that. And you haven't even packed it yet. So once you pack it, then we'll be able to unpack it later. But you gave us that's a really great kind of overview of it. It sounds really wonderful. And yeah, that's something we'll look forward to getting to see down the road. But in the meantime, good luck with that and have fun with it.
Yes, I need all the luck I can.
Yeah, luck is important in life, isn't it? I wanted to talk about voice and style in a couple of your stories, just to use as kind of contrasting. The use of language in these two stories is very different. Mill Pond, which is sort of a classically composed short story in a way. It has like a, you know, maybe like an Alice Munro kind of like a real kind of traditional classical form of short story. And then contrasted with Be a Woman, which is very experimental in its use of language. It's very playful. You know, you use sentence fragments, you actually make up words in that, which I love. So before we start talking about those, are either of those going to be in the collection that you're working on or that you're nearing completion with?
Yeah, so they're both currently in the collection. Now, if that changes, you know, I just rearranged the collection and cut three stories from it the other day. So who knows what will happen?
Okay.
But they are currently in the collection, yes.
All right. They're so different, you know, in voice. Start with Be a Woman, because, you know, this is a third third person narrative, right? In this one?
Yes. Yeah.
But it's a close third person where you really feel like it could be coming from her thoughts and feelings. Maybe you could just talk a little bit about the way you use language in that story. Was that something that just kind of evolved as you wrote the story? Or did you have like an intention of doing something kind of playful with that?
Yeah, that's a great question. Thanks, John. So that story I wrote as I was reading Ulysses by James Joyce, which is probably no surprise.
That's
it
great.
Actually started with a lot of double colons as well. And one of my mentors was like, you gotta stop with that. And I was like, okay. But it was a story that I had in my mind for a long time. And I had a document pulled up on my computer the day I started writing it in earnest. And I had just written, "They are camping and isn't it wonderful?" And it had a question mark. And that's the first line of the story. And it had a question mark there. And then I was reading James Joyce and I pulled up the document and I cut the question mark and just put a period there. And for some reason that like punctuation change, it was a class that I took with Lily Wong, who was teaching James Joyce, teaching Ulysses through the lens of punctuation. So I was learning a lot about punctuation, which has always been, until that class, was like such a struggle for me, because I liked to sort of create my own rules about punctuation in my stories. And, you know, I had lots of professors telling me, you can't do that. Like, you can't just use comma splices because you like them. and I was like, well, why not? That's how the story sounds in my head. And so she taught me so much. I owe so much to her for that class, because I was learning about punctuation and I learned that as long as I was consistent and I was teaching the reader to read punctuation how I wanted them to read it, then I could do basically whatever I wanted. Yeah, so that class inspired me to sort of take the question mark off and put a period there. And then suddenly I landed on this very kind of, I describe many of my protagonists and narrators as sort of obsessive interior, you know, interior characters who just sort of like the world kind of collapses into their interior and into their psychology. And I think that this story is like that as well, even though there's like real drama happening in the exterior too, in this story, which is not as true with She Can't Get Off the Floor and of The Eating Variety, right? Where all the drama is sort of taking place in the interior. This story has like real stakes and drama in the exterior as well.
Yeah, so let's just kind of, so for listeners who haven't read the story, the main character is a student athlete who is on a track team, long distance. She runs long distance, and they're camping, it sounds like, and the coach, who's a woman, is allowing them to kind of decompress with a little bit of alcohol, even though they're teenagers. And something happens. The main character has a sort of boyfriend who is behaving kind of oddly. He hasn't joined in. He's kind of observing, you know, he's behaving kind of strangely. And then something happens. The coach introduces this woman to another adult who I guess she had been an athlete with in her youth, a man named Jack. And things happen in the story that are disturbing. Is it a spoiler to say what happens in the story, or, you know?
I feel like hopefully good stories, like even if you know what happens, right, you still want to go to read them to experience the process of it. But it's up to you, John.
An assault takes place in this story. It's something that, you know, the language, it's, and this is where your use of language becomes like a way of kind of protecting the reader, I found, which was really unique. It's a kind of a poetic manner in which you're expressing as the writer what's happening, you know, the events, but it's still part of kind of like an interior monologue. You know, it's kind of a hybrid thing where we feel sort of we're at enough of a distance that we can look at it more objectively, you know, than as disturbing as it still is. I'm really not doing justice to the experience. And it is one of those kinds of experiences that's hard to describe, you know, when a story does that to you. And that was a very unusual experience for me as a reader to have. Did that make any sense, what I just said?
Yeah, no, I think like for me, language is inflected. Always I feel like language is inflected by character. And then with this story in particular, with Be a Woman, Maddie, I think the reason I'm inhabiting this kind of language is because it aligns with Maddie's character, right? Mm. Like she is a young woman who is getting drunk for the first time. So the language is often a little bit defamiliarized. And then in the end of the story, she experiences this assault, but she's sort of not sure how to make sense of it herself. So I think as a reader, ideally, right, you see through like her sort of illogical leaps that she's making. Like at first she thinks that this Jack character is like trying to give her mouth to mouth, like CPR. And, and she's like not understanding what's happening. And part of that is like, she does have this like naivety that is maybe, you know, I've had readers come to this and say like, oh, she needs to be younger. But again, I was a very young teenager. And so I felt like, you know, it is true that many, I believe she's 14 in the story. I can't remember if I changed it for the book, but it's true that many 14-year-olds are more mature, but there are 14-year-olds who are less mature. And that was my experience. And so I think that language there is really doing the work of reflecting her experience of the events and like her sort of drunkenness. So it's like very convoluted in a way. Mm. If that makes sense.
Oh, it does. It does. And the alcohol, you know, it's important at the beginning of the story, you establish that, you know, that these are young people who have been allowed to drink beer or whatever. And then you kind of forget about that until the story, you know, unfolds and it becomes more and more dreamlike as it progresses. And at the climax, the moments where these terrible things begin to happen, the reader is trying to process what's going on at the same time as the protagonist is. And that takes some doing as a writer. I mean, the skill that's necessary to have us share that experience at kind of simultaneously is, again, these are unusual experiences for me as a reader. I can't say that I could, you know, single out other stories where I've had a similar kind of experience. And I mean, obviously, I don't think there's any intention necessarily for you as a writer to know that that's going to, you know, this is where you're headed with this and what you're hoping the reader will experience. But maybe there is in the writing of that and the way that it kind of unfolds at the end. Did you think about, you know, the reader's experience of that at all?
I mean, that's such a good question. I think, you know, with writing, I think most of us, I mean, I don't want to speak for everyone as a writer, but, you know, you get so wrapped up in a piece or in a story that it's hard to see different angles from it because you are in your own head about it so much. And for me, like, I feel like with my characters, even the characters that are like not great people, which there are a lot of in my fictions, I feel like there's like a part of me that like I have to put a part of me in those characters, or like they demand that from me. And I think that so when that happens, it's really hard to see how a reader is coming to it. So I rely a lot on my readers, my good friends, my mentors, who will read my work and sort of reflect back what their experience is. And I think there's a sort of misconception that writing is this very solo activity, and it can be very isolating, of course, but I feel like writing for me is very collaborative in a lot of ways, and I really rely heavily on my good friends and mentors to read through my work and reflect back what they're experiencing, because I just get too much in my head about it, and it's hard to sort of see the forest through the trees, as it were.
Yeah, but that's the advantage of being in a program or programs like you've been in, you know, where you have really highly qualified people giving you valuable feedback. I'm so glad, you know, that you're able to talk about these things today. We're getting to the end of the hour already, which is always so upsetting for me to see when I look at the clock. That story, Be a Woman, and is that one that is also unpublished at this stage of things, or?
That one is published in a journal called New Madrid, which unfortunately had to close its doors a couple years ago. So
that's not available at this point for people to read
not really,
online.
Yeah.
Okay. There were just so many great fun things. And, you know, when you make up words, I love when writers make up words like frownable. Mm-hmm. Frownable was one. Mind picture, you know, all one word. And then, you know, the fragments, I just love, as a reader, when a writer takes those kinds of risks in the writing. Falling is weightless, sinking is weightful is another line from that. Just that's an extraordinary story. Let's just end with Perfect Possibility, since it's kind of the, in some ways, the polar opposite stylistically of that story. As I said, it's a much more kind of classically composed story in terms of the language, but it has a lot of unique things, you know, even so. It's a story about someone dealing with grief. It's two women who are friends, one whose father has just passed away, and the other friend whose father is still living and, you know, is having a little bit of survivor's guilt because of that, I think, and feeling inadequate in the ways that she is responding to her friend in terms of, you know, how do you respond to someone, you know, who's lost a father or a mother, a loss of that magnitude? What's appropriate? And is that, you know, can anything ever be appropriate? That character, Emily, who is the protagonist in this story, is kind of struggling with all the things that she's trying to do to help her friend Marie that she feels are just utterly inadequate or maybe even wrong in some instances. So yeah, just in contrast, the experience of writing that story and the manner in which it was written, what was the process like for you writing that story?
So Perfect Possibility, I feel like it is a more traditional story in some ways, but I also feel like it is doing things with interiority and punctuation that is not unlike Be a Woman. It's just a little more muted for my understanding of it. But, and I also think that for me, like I was saying with language being inflected by character, like this is like Emily's voice. That is how her voice works. It's, you know, she's very obsessive. She's very collapsed in on herself, like her good friend or who she thinks is her good friend, but the reader sort of starts to put together that maybe they aren't great friends as, you know, maybe they're just kind of coworkers as the story unfolds. But her good friend is dealing with this grief and this loss. And Emily is sort of like having this intense like jealousy and possessiveness around Marie. She wants to sort of be inside her grief with her in a way that feels like a little dangerous, I think, at times. And I think that for me, like when I write a story, sometimes I have an idea for a thing that I want to happen. Like in Mill Pond, for example, I wanted to tell this ghost story that my mom told me. So they're embedded in the story as a ghost story. So there are certain times that I want to tell a specific piece of information, and that sort of inspires a piece. But for the most part, the way I start a story is really landing on the voice. And for Emily, it was the line, it was kind of the first paragraph, which I rewrote, I mean, maybe 200 times. But the line, "It was so green and dad should not be dead in spring," or it was something like that. I forget how it's changed, but that line, "It was so green," with the exclamation mark, like that is sort of the line that landed me in the story. And I think that that's true for a lot of my short stories, is that the way in is through voice. And so just navigating and figuring out what Emily's voice was really productive for me.
Yeah. And dads should not die in the spring.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I just pulled it up. Yes. And even though, again, it's third person, it's very close third person, you clearly get the sense of that character, as you're saying, in everything, you know, that comes out as the story unfolds, you know, and all the ways that things are focused, you know, from her Emily's point of view. And you do some experimental things with the language in this, where it's not as intentional. It's not as intentional seeming as it is in Be a Woman. In this case, it's much more subtle. So the reader is not even really picking up on it. And yet it absolutely, you know, is kind of straying from the tried and true way of doing things, which is really cool. And I'm glad you brought that to my attention, because now I'm going to go back and look at some of the things that I might not have even been conscious of as I was reading it. So these are things that as a reader, sometimes you're not even aware of. That's the kind of the fun of this. It's like they're so subtle that, you know, even though they're there, it takes having a conversation with the writer, it takes that to really learn of the kind of unique things that you've done in this story. Now, you've got a couple of years left before you're done with your PhD, and you're pretty sure you're going to pursue an academic career.
Yeah, I have like 1 to 2 years left in my PhD program, just depending on when I take my exams and what I want to use for my dissertation and when my committee will let me graduate. And then afterwards, I definitely, my goal is to work in academia. I really love teaching. It's just something that I feel really passionate about. I felt passionate about since I was young. And yeah, that's the plan, but it sort of depends on a book publication, I think. So I'm also a great bartender.
It's good to have those kinds of life skills, right? You know, it can't hurt, but yeah, hopefully you will not need to resort to that ever again. Having been a bartender and a waiter, you know, in pursuit of my career, I know exactly what that can be like. So, but yeah, let's hope. I have a strong feeling that you won't need to resort to that again, Allie. Well, this has been just amazingly fun and enlightening. And thank you so much for being so willing to share some, you know, very personal and sensitive things about yourself and your life. That takes great courage. And I really do appreciate you feeling like you could do that. And I know people are going to learn from this, the experience of listening to this. And, you know, I know my understanding of a lot of the things that we were talking about has grown substantially. So thank you for all of that.
Well, thank you so much, John. It's been a pleasure talking to you. And I just appreciate all that you do for the short story. And it's been, you know, it's so fun to listen to these podcasts. So it's an honor to be here.
Well, the honor is mine in having you here. And yeah, I'm hoping to see your books out there. I'm looking forward to that. I'm sure, you know, that day will come. And, you know, in the meantime, continued good luck with your studies and in your life. Best of everything. And we'll stay in touch. Okay.
All right. Thank you so much, John.
You'll find links to Allison's stories and essays on her website, AllisonFieldBell.com. And now we'll move on to the short story, River Mountain Summer, which was first published in West Branch. So here it is, River Mountain Summer by Allison Field Bell. The tree was old, the second arborist will confirm, but it was inspected this season. It was healthy, and because this second arborist is a religious person, he, unlike the first arborist, a loyal naturalist, will say that it was a terrible act of God, a tragedy. He tells the media this, tragedy, act of God. We watch it on television a week afterward, noting how clean and white his shirt is, wrong for our River Mountain camp. Whenever young people die, he says, trailing off in solemnity, leaving us to mourn, to obsess, to imagine. It is our camp, and we want to imagine swiftness. Sound, canopy of branches, nothing. But possibly this is not the case. Possibly it is sound, branch, fear, tree bark, oak leaves, pain. California Black Oak. The first arborist will identify it for strangers who watch our tragedy recorded, unfolding. In a photograph, she points to its long, fat branch, split and cracked near the trunk, a collapse of bark and fierce orange heartwood onto the stage, the dining hall, the Session 3 summer camp staff, summer camp campers who, until this moment of splitting, are in the dining hall stacking pancakes, 1, 3, 7, or on the stage, cross-legged, thinking river, imagining mountain. We, of course, cannot know for certain the final moments of those immediately killed, Charlie and Eric and William, and three of the oldest camper boys, but we can imagine. We do know for certain that, before these final moments, Charlie, the camp therapist, is on the stage. We imagine she is thinking river, our river, thinking the place beyond the office and grove of pines down the trail to our place, the spot along our river where her favorite granite reading rock is still cold and in the shade. By 10, the rock will be all heat and sun and, on any other day, she'd be there, body strewn across it. Charlie on the stage, body on the worn wood planks, directly in line with the long, fat branch of the California black oak, not yet split, not yet collapsed. On the stage, also, are the arts and crafts specialist, a wilderness leader, three off-duty kitchen, a man from maintenance, the assistant director from New Hampshire. And around them, the stage is littered with curled oak leaves and brittle oak sticks and oak seeds which look like discarded oak knuckles. Their breakfast plates between the oak litter and the crossed legs. Eric, Colleen, Mira, David, Rebecca, Raymond, Caitlin. They are arguing over pancakes, over William, and Mira, as usual, is exhilarated by her young love defense of him. My William, she thinks, and Eric is teasing, laughing, imitating, and there is a moment before these final moments when our whole mountain river summer world is undone by sound. How do you know when a tree limb is about to fall? Reporters ask this of both arborists. We watch, read, listen in dismay. The word limb applied to tree, the way a tree can grow two equal-sized arms, branching off at the base of the trunk like a torso. How do you know? There is a distinct sound. Neither arborist says this, but those who are there will never stop hearing it. Friday morning, Session 3. There are all the normal morning sounds of voices. children and late teens, early 20s, mid-30s, hyper and hungover, joking, scolding. There's the sound of so many mouths chewing or sipping milk or cooling down coffee with streams of breath. The sound of backpacks, of radio static, a door swung open, another closed. The sound of shoes on tile, shoes on sticks, shoes on dirt and grass, shoes moving between concrete and bathroom, wood deck and kitchen. There are the muffled kitchen sounds. The dish line, the metal dish to metal counter slide to the chubby boy or the skinny boy or the girl with braces, the girl with a purple streak in her hair. Their voices asking, "More, please." Pancakes and syrup, those sounds, too. The industrial camp griddle, the syrup bucket. And there's the muffled music sound. For the dishwashers and the cigarette smokers in the smoker pit, something heavy with bass but muted by window and walls. Near the stage, with Charlie and Eric and the others, there are the light forest sounds, small animals and birds skittering and hopping between branches, displacing bits of tree to the earth. There's the sound of swallowing water, the sound of scraping metal fork against plastic plate, the Mira defending William sound, Eric's laughter, lively sounds, the sounds of breathing. To find spiritual camp peace, our executive director tells us, in praise of this place, in praise of this nature, we can always breathe. Breathe in the mountains, the river, the early summer lupin, the chamomile soft under sandal. We can breathe and hesitate and take time to listen, to be silent. A moment alone by the river, a small meditation by a ponderosa, a pillar of our river summer mountain philosophy. Quiet moments in nature, so even small sounds become meaningful. Human sounds become distinct. The human sound slop, heartbeat, breath, body shifting. In the morning and at mealtimes, the sounds are exponentially larger, but there is a kind of meaning to them, too, a comfort. Familiar sounds make us buoyant, push us to the surface of the mountain river sound mass, so that we are both separate and inseparable. No surface without a body to support it, no branch without a trunk. The sound is the body, each of us a surface. Then there is abruptly a new sound. We know from Charlie, our camp therapist, that there is a process to grief, months and years and moving through a series of stages, denial and anger the first two. Here is Charlie's body on our River Mountain stage. Here are our stages unfolding before the television, beside the split branch, inside the dining hall. Both arborists agree that it was impossible to predict. The tree, the branch, healthy, tragedy. The stages, our grief, time collapsing in branches and leaves and fierce orange heartwood. The first stage is denial. This new sound, which is a tree sound, but is more like a terrible human sound, like fireworks, like war. A few of us will come to know about war, Iraq or Afghanistan or some new place someone decides to send us, older and marching through desert, listening through air raids. But we are not at war now, here. We are at peace and familiar sounds and nature. So we rub our ears, scold ourselves for our wayward imaginings. This is our camp, our mountain river morning sounds. The second stage is anger. Initially just an irritation, like a car horn interrupting a pleasant walk. Uninvited, unnecessary. There are no cars here, no cell phones. We are in this place in praise of nature. Stage 3 is bargaining. From this moment moving forward, we swear to forever appreciate uninterrupted morning sounds. Even when a camper's whining voice erodes hungover patience, and if not for our good camp conditioning of campers come first, counselor staff positivity, we would certainly hurl this camper across the dining hall. We swear to God, or nature, or self, to always celebrate the morning, even when we're sleepless or still chilled, or hating the sun butter substitute for peanut. Stage 4. Depression. Pointless to move, to crawl or run or roll away. Stage 5. Final stage. The sound is attached to a source, and the source will do what the source will do. The tree will buckle and crack and split like fireworks, like war. An act of nature. Stage, roof, pain. The first arborist will talk about sudden oak death. Upon inspection, she says, I have ruled this out as the cause. Phytophthora remorum was not present, she says. She does not know what, within the tree, failed it. A systemic problem or localized, she does not know. I imagine a combination of factors, she says. We imagine William, a combination of factors, refilling the coffee despite it being the job of a prep cook, not the shift lead. William at the coffee bar thinking, quit construction, fully commit to culinary training, launch a catering company. William scooping the coffee mud into a plastic bucket. Nothing too ambitious. Start small. Build from the baseboards up. He knows about baseboards. After all, he has stood in many empty lots beside a pile of lumber, a truck of tools. Has stood in steel-toed boots and listened while a contractor assigned him tasks. Small tasks that required small pieces like nails and wood wedges. Large tasks that required whole teams called in from the outside, masons and plumbers. He has seen places grow from lot to frame to house. With his body, his hands, he has formed raw material, tree and metal, into a home. And with food, too, he thinks, as he peels a paper filter from the stack and flattens it into the metal holder. A process that does not require such lengthy lingering. It is a kind of forming of materials. A company, small at first, just dinners for friends, to practice his recipes. And here, at the moment of sound outside the dining hall, and still denied by all of us, he will, does, did, lift the metal holder to the machine and consider the coffee itself. The inconsistent texture of each ground bean, imported from some countryside he will never visit. We know this last part, of course. William will never visit Honduras, or Guatemala, or Cambodia, or Uganda. He will never visit Peru. And in the next moment of the sound transfer from California black oak to dining hall roof, he pauses over the surface of crushed beans, inhales the roasted smell of them, and curses all those places he will never visit, the whole coffee ordeal that he will never master. There isn't time for it. At a certain point, a person has to wrestle time into the possibilities of mastery. He cannot know building and food and coffee and rock climbing and sex and mushrooms and the great American novel and the great American highway, and the right thing to say to a young, pretty prep cook who believes love can happen in 2 weeks, one summer at camp in the mountains by the river. We imagine Mira screaming and trapped beneath a thigh-thick oak branch. The first arborist will examine the branches for biomechanical failure, surveying the degree of damage, calculating factors like wind turbulence and ice damage. She calls it tree failure, and we imagine the body failing. Eric's body, our arts and crafts specialist. And Mira, only a few feet from it, not thinking of it or of William or of what he's said or not said. There is pain, and there is survival, and there is pain. Broken ribs, broken femur, cracked collarbone. Later there will be grief and many nights without sleep and many lovers without love, because a lover dead is the perfect lover. A ghost settles into her, and every river or pancake is divided between ghost and non-ghost. She searches for him in every restaurant and every man on every construction site. She curses him for taking from her the hammer, the kitchen aisle, and years from now, we imagine, she will pass her pruny newborn girl, named after Charlie, to her husband, and she will despise William for hesitating at the coffee machine, for being dead instead of just an asshole. Some of us will call the first arborist an asshole. She's cold and calculating, and look at her standing there in our camp with our tree, our stage and dining hall broken beneath it. She enters our tree into the International Tree Failure Database. She does not give us something to blame, internal defects or a history of droughts or a negligent director or the obscure beetle burrowing through bark. The second arborist gives some of us comfort in his abstraction, in his God talk. The second arborist allows for some of us to enter into acceptance. And then we imagine Eric, who in his only moment of possible acceptance, the tree will do what the tree will do, does not accept. His body tenses and rises and moves in a direction to preserve itself. No, 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 in the wrong direction. And in the final moments, he's thinking of the necessity of home. We imagine this because in our oak tree tragedy, we think of home. We want to be there, far away, safe, watching it on the television. We imagine this, too, because for us, our River Mountain summer is home, far away, safe. When we are in cities or on freeways or sleepless in our small hometowns, we desire camp. Welcome home, we tell each other, each summer. Among the tall, tall trees, we say. For Eric, in his last moments, the desire is for his desert home, the nighttime air, the starlit sprawl, the sun-bleached, dusty, luminous shapes scattered across the landscape. Placitas, New Mexico. A yearning for the monsoon-rutted driveways that sweep and network across the village that, so many summers ago, brought him and his brother so many times to the neighbors with the hot tub and the three daughters. The bike ride back, too, he desires. Drunk, they'd turn off their headlamps, hands off the handlebars, coast and pedal and coast and fly. A home he had wished his whole life to leave, too small and dry. But in the end, his body fights its way back there. And following the moment of wrong direction, precisely when the 4-foot diameter of California black oak branch enters the space directly over his body, his skull, Eric thinks something simple, small, a memory of pleasure. Cotton candy, for example, the special carnival sweet shared with his brother, the sticky cloud-light handfuls in his mouth, his body, dissolving. The first arborist says that the California black oak population is on the decline in the park, that scientists are studying and hypothesizing, that one hypothesis includes a study of road ecology, of human impact, and we are confused by the implications, our River Mountain summer, our tall, tall trees. We are unsure of what we've lost. We have lost 3 camper boys. They are not immediately killed by California black oak, but by 1960s pine beams. We know that on the other side of the dining hall, our assistant director, Ben, is pushing campers out the doors with his voice and with his arms spread swan-like, ushering the confused, screaming children with a stern embrace of wings. The microphone is still in his right hand from the morning announcements, tight in his fist like a scepter. Later, the television will commend his bravery. "How many children you must have saved," a woman with her own microphone says to him. And we commend his calm, his camper-come-first camp attitude. Some of us envy it. Ben, taking the hand of a girl from G5 who has lost her glasses and is bleeding from a deep cut in her calf. She is a camper who nightly misses her parents and the way they leave a small light on in the hallway outside her bedroom. Ben presses her hand into the hand of her counselor, Katie, whose thoughts are of survival. Her own, her girlfriend's nearby. She wants to scream it. "Run, Shauna!" And to herself, too. "Run! Screw the campers and their slow little legs, their panicked pre-adolescent fear. It is easy to hate them, hate the way their bodies are clogging the spaces between tables, spilling syrup and pancake to the floor, a slick breakfast obstacle course. They're clamoring over tabletop and bench, pushing and pulling at each other. Katie wants to barrel through them, to grip her lover's hand and run as fast and hard as she can, propel herself and her lover over them, away from the falling debris, the mangled oak and pine, the plaques crumbling off the walls. We imagine this because we want to. We want to run away from the wreckage, the dining hall, the branches and the talk of it afterwards. Video, photographs, obituaries, interviews with us and our families, with Shauna and Katie, with the camp board, with one arborist doubted and then the next praised, the news of memorials, the news of our camp reopening, the news of our pine trees near the office removed as an extra precautionary measure. But Katie does not run. She crouches down and urges the girl onto her back. The girl weighs about nothing. Her bones are bird bones. A plaque alone could crush them. The girl grips Katie's neck, threatening her air supply. She will have bruises there, small purple imprints of girl hands that Shauna will outline tenderly the next evening. But she'll claim that it was worth it. Her bravery, too, is commended. The camper's mother embraces her on national television, desperate with gratitude. "My daughter," she says again and again, and the cameras capture it. "She saved my baby girl." There are many of these stories, counselors being heroes to campers. Because here, the counselors are leading them away from the dining hall, carrying them, holding their hands, pushing them beyond the doors, towards the cabins, to the grassy girls' side field, which is our emergency location, our place of soccer tournaments and softball games and competitive obstacle courses. Today, it is true, some of us are brave, but mostly we're lucky, dumb mountain river summer luck. And we've mostly been lucky. It is our camp, and there are risks everywhere. Rattlesnakes, poison oak, mountain lions, mountain hikes and climbs, slick rocks beside snow-melt rivers. At the river now, for example, there are places we cannot visit. Upper and middle and lower falls, impassable. No trail at all, just poison oak pounded into the sides of the sloping canyon walls by a thick belt of whitewater. We tell ourselves safety first, risk assessment, challenge by choice. We are certified in CPR, in first aid. We are TB tested and swim tested, and some of us are NOLS WFA, and some of us are EMT, and two of us are MD. And we do know about death. Our River Mountain camp, our past, an off-duty counselor, a camper on a day hike, two wilderness leaders in a climbing accident, and most recently, 3 years ago, a girl died in the river. Some of us knew the girl well. Katrina from Seattle. Cat, we call her. She spent the summer rotating through bathing suits, all polka-dotted. Red, black, pink. She slipped and fell at Upper. Some of us searched for her. We searched underwater while we waited for the helicopter and the official searchers to arrive. We did not need them to arrive. We found Kat beneath the cascade at Lower. We determined she had cracked her head and, unconscious, ridden the snowmelt mountain water from upper to middle to lower. We painted a plaque to memorialize her. We will paint a plaque to memorialize today. We'll nail it to the stump of the tree and force ourselves to feel lucky. Lucky campers treated for cuts and pain and fear by Miguel, our camp doctor. Some campers are lucky but need a hospital, a length of stitches, a bone set back. Some maintenance, arts and crafts, kitchen, wilderness, office staff are lucky without injury or lucky with minor injury. One counselor is initially lucky and ultimately unlucky, stuck in the hospital in a coma. Colleen, our wilderness leader, on the stage near Mira, is lucky and unconscious. She will stay lucky and return to the wilderness to lead trips of high school teenagers and delinquent children and bored adults. But right now she is lucky and unaware of the tree and the others beside her. David, prep cook, concussed and overbruised with broken clavicle, broken scapula. Rebecca, prep cook, fractured spine. Raymond, maintenance, gambled in a direction and it had been right. He is crawling out from the preserved space between the raised stage and the branches. He will claim that he is never returning to camp, not next summer or any summers or any camps. Both arborists, when questioned about precautionary measures, refer to tree risk assessment. The International Society of Arboriculture has officially sanctioned protocol, records, paperwork. They evaluate the soil conditions, the topographical grade, the foliage, crown density, the interior branches, the presence or absence of vines or mistletoe or moss. They evaluate the trunk, the roots, and the root collar. They create a matrix. It's a science of probability, the likelihood of impacting target, the consequences of failure. They factor in the park, too, and our camp's desire to preserve the nature of it. The second arborist will contend that all humans are in God's hands. The first arborist will, exasperated, admit that it's impossible to guarantee 100% the safety of any given tree. We understand this. We cannot cut down every tree near every building. We cannot refuse to ever stand or sit or gather beneath them. And besides, what of the open spaces? Open because they are tree-lined. Tree-lined because this is our mountain river camp. And what of the river, the trees beside and bending over it? What of our off-duty time there, sunbathing or rock-hopping or reading on sun-warmed granite? And then Charlie. There is still Charlie who was thinking river and now nothing. Charlie, who was thinking about the flat river rock that is still cold but will be all heat and sun by 10. But she will not be there, strewn across it, because she is here, strewn across the stage. Body broken up by branches. A technically unqualified therapist, mid-PhD, but a former camper, a friend to directors and the older staff. The television will say that she was a young woman with a bright future, a promising career, a passion for helping people. Her career interests emerged from the inability to reconcile parts of her body with parts of her mind. We know this from Ariel, who is lucky and uninjured. Charlie had body issues, Ariel says, again and again, like there is some unrecovered clue. We hear body issues and we, some of us, imagine our own. Why sex, for example? Why does the body desire it, while the brain locks up on the one time with the one man, a boy, really, a long time ago? And it wasn't really sex, maybe. Semantics become important to memory. It wasn't sex, but it resembled sex, and therefore sex resembled it. Therefore, we imagine mid-30s alone with a favorite isolated river rock and a friend, Ariel, who will blame herself for persuading Charlie of the job. Summer, mountain, river. We hear body, and we imagine body. Body crushed by tree or body beside the river. We know that she went there alone, to be naked alone, while the rest of us, staff only, went to river spots together, to be naked together. We imagine Charlie and her damaged psychology wanting to undamage the damaged psychology of children. Food. Not wanting to be too heavy. Feeling like the weight of her body very possibly could sink her into the dirt, the stage, the floor, turn a surface into quicksand, swallow her, fat feet, fat ankles first. Her ankles now no longer ankles. They are part tree, part stage, part bone, no longer bone. We hear body issues and imagine our bodies vulnerable now in ways we hadn't imagined before. Our bodies beneath a tree, and then against it, a trunk, a torso and a branch, a limb. Our bodies, we had been told by our mountain river minds, were not separate from the nature we exposed them to. Our bodies are extensions of the earth. Our torsos, trunks. Our limbs, branches. And here is the first arborist telling us statistics. Oak tree age. Ours over 100, but some up to 5. Our oak tree branch betraying its age and our bodies. Our unlucky river mountain summer. And so Charlie's body, the effect of the initial sound on it, something that emerged from within her, from her diaphragm maybe, a kind of tearing up and out from an essential core location through muscle and bone, from the skin of her body, to the black oak bark, splitting that juncture between limb and torso, torso and limb. We imagine this because this is how we feel, the moment of the splitting, the cycle of the moments repeating, collapsing, the tree merging with bodies. The second arborist will tell us that the tree was very heavy, that the deaths were unavoidable. He says God 3 times in his interview. In the hospital, Caitlin, our assistant director, mostly lucky and on the stage near the others, asks about Charlie 8 times before the nurses and her family deem her stable and cognitive enough to be told. Is Charlie's head okay? She asks over and over. And also, her neck. Is she paralyzed? The neck is not the problem. The problem is the tree, its weight and height and unpredictability. We can never look at trees the same way again. Both arborists have confirmed this. There are impossible forces at work inside them. Sap shifting, water moving through dense interior veins, rings expanding and contracting. No one could have known. Both arborists agree. Nothing could have prevented it. And we close ourselves off to it, turn off the television, and remember the moments after. The moment on the girls' side field, where currently we are holding onto each other and our campers, and closing our eyes against the half-broken shell of our dining hall, where Ben is still brave and directing the flow of the building's innards, directing us to this field. We try to take role, who is present and accounted for, who is not present but accounted for, who is not present, not accounted for. There are many in all categories. We try to organize by bunk, by urgency of injury, by age, by counselor camper pair, by siblings, by tables closest to black oak, by tables furthest away. Then we try to concentrate on Gavin, our song leader, who has somehow remembered to remove his guitar from the stand that holds, when not in Ben's hands, the microphone. Gavin has his guitar and is playing something slow and sad, and it makes some of us afraid, and when we think of it later, it makes some of us angry. It is our tragedy. It should be our memory soundtrack, our imagined futures of our camp staff, camp campers. But we see ourselves outside of ourselves, on the television, in the news, our fear and singing and dining hall and stage, our California black oak. And right now, in this moment, we are scanning all the trees that populate the camp, the pines and oaks that have, until today, been nothing but fodder for song, for nature, love, and decree. Right now, the trees are closing in on us. The sunlight is exploding blue across the thin mountain sky, and we collide and tremble into each other, into embrace, through adrenaline and memory, over and across the warm, wet grass. Thank you, Allison, for allowing us to read that profound and heartrending story. Well, that's the end of the episode. Thank you for listening. We're going to be taking a break for the summer, so the podcast will be on hiatus for the months of July and August. But please join us again in September when we return with a whole new roster of talented writers we want to introduce to you. The music you hear at the beginning of each episode is by C.S. Fuqua, and the closing music is by Matt Hawkins. You can find out more about their music from a link on our homepage at shortstorytoday.com. You've been listening to Short Story Today, where we celebrate short stories and the authors who write them. Across the bridge of stories, I'll find you. Hold your tongue, boy.